welcome. From the expectant hush, I feel as though I should have a collar on. But I don't. I do have the pleasure, though, to welcome you to this evening. I'm Harmon Dunathan, Dean of Academic Affairs at Rhodes College. I'm welcoming you to the first of the lectures in the fourth annual series, supported by the Lillian Maury Moss Endowment for the Visual Arts. Dr. Kelly is the 14th speaker in this series that's brought Memphis and Rhodes fresh perspectives on art, and in particular on American art and architecture. Our lectures have come from many American universities, from the British Museum, from the Vatican, and of course from the National Gallery. Rhodes College is honored to be the host institution for this endowment, which benefits our entire city and which is made possible by the outstanding generosity of Mr. Maury Moss. Mr. Moss is in the audience tonight, and I want to take this opportunity to ask him to stand and accept our thanks. I would also like to express the gratitude of all of us associated with Rhodes for the help and cooperation of the session and congregation of the Evergreen Presbyterian Church. Evergreen Church has always extended their boundaries to include the Rhodes campus and community in our activities, and we are very grateful to them. The theme for our fourth session of distinguished lectures is Landscape in American Art, and we are gratified to be able to begin our series with Dr. Franklin Kelly. Dr. Kelly is in the best tradition of the American Academy. That is, excellence will out. He did his undergraduate work at Chapel Hill and his graduate work at Williams College and at the University of Delaware, where he received his PhD in 1985. His dissertation there on Frederick Church won the 1986 Sifford Prize. He has moved rapidly from the Minneapolis Art Institute to assistant curator at the National Gallery, and in 1987 to curator of American art at the National Gallery. Dr. Kelly, we've looked forward with great anticipation to your talk this evening. Welcome to Memphis and to Rhodes.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'd like to add my own word of thanks to Mr. Moss for this wonderful opportunity to be speaking to you about a subject which is, I admit, very dear to my heart. It's also a first for me to be speaking about church in a church, but it's something he would have appreciated, because I do wish I'd brought a slide of this. He often signed his name on his letters, the initials F.E., then with a little picture of a church. And it is, in fact, a church with a steeple and a colonnade at the front, which looks very much like this. On a more personal note, my father is a Presbyterian theologian, so I don't think he ever dreamed he would see me at the pulpit. But this is something he would, he is indeed, I'm sure, sorry to miss for that reason. But the final reason, which it's particularly interesting to me to be speaking about Frederick Church here in the church, is that in the mid-19th century, there was a much closer relationship between all aspects of American culture and the arts, but in particular, a very strong relationship between members of the clergy. Church's close friend and actually his accomplice on sketching tours was a man named the Reverend Louis Noble, who was a writer about the arts as well as the pastor of the church in Catskill, New York, where Church went to services. So in that sense, I don't think Frederick Church would have found it at all unusual that people would be gathering in a religious institution to hear about his paintings. I think he was also enough of a believer in his own art that he would hope you would leave with a sense of worship after seeing them. If we could have the lights down in the first two slides. This is Frederick Church on the left there. He was born in 1826 and lived out the century, dying in 1900. His most important years as a painter, however, were from the late 1840s through the 1850s and the 1860s, a very rich time in our cultural history. And in one particular instance, in the spring of 1859, it's safe to say that Frederick Church was by far the most famous landscape painter in America, and he was that because of the work you see on the right. It's a work called The Heart of the Andes. It is actually a painting larger than you see it on the screen. It measures a little bit over 5 feet high by 10 feet wide. It belongs to the Metropolitan Museum in New York, where you can see it today. But in 1859, if you wanted to see it, you had to go to a special exhibition which had been arranged just for this painting. You paid 25 cents, and that was in an era in American history where 25 cents would also buy you a good pair of shoes, so it was not cheap. You stood in line because there were thousands of other people who wanted to see it, and you went then, when your time came, into a room that had been darkened, the light blocked out except for the light which fell on the painting. You saw the picture in an enormous carved black walnut frame that looked like a window. It had a curtain that had been drawn back from the picture, and around it there were dried tropical plants that Church had brought back with him from South America. And as you walked in, you clearly had a sense that you were not looking at a painting, but looking at some kind of vision of another world. There were pamphlets that you could read about the painting. There were newspaper articles. You could bring opera glasses and look at it, study it at your heart's content. It was one of those experiences which it's very difficult in this day and age when we're used to going to museums and seeing masterpiece after masterpiece or going to special exhibitions and in some ways being overwhelmed. It's almost impossible, I think, for us to realize just how overwhelming this experience must have been. But Mark Twain, the famous writer, gives some idea because he went three times and left saying that he simply could not take it all in at once. He was amazed by it. But more than being entertaining, and more than being simply a special thing to do on a Saturday afternoon, The Heart of the Andes was, for those who went to see it, an uplifting and instructive experience. And we need to consider the words of Church's friend and one of his literary interpreters, a young writer named Theodore Winthrop, who said of the painting, quote, "The poetry is before our eyes. A look can read it. For this is what great art alone can do and triumphs in doing. It gives a vision of glory, and everyone who beholds it is a poet." And Winthrop continued, "A great work of art is a delight and a lesson. It demands far more than vague confidence that we can safely admire without committing ourselves. It is not enough to look a while and like a little and evade discrimination with easy commonplaces." The Heart of the Andes was by far the greatest single work of Church's career, and it is, in fact, in my opinion, one of the most ambitious and most complex landscape paintings ever created anywhere. But how are we to understand it? How are we to appreciate what Winthrop called its lesson? It's not hard to understand the delight when you stand in front of this great painting in the Metropolitan, because it's beautifully painted, it's colorful, it's delightful to the eye. But to understand its lesson, we need to look more deeply into Church's own career, and in particular into the role that landscape painting played in mid-19th century America. Church, as I mentioned, was born in 1826. He came from Hartford, Connecticut, and he had a singular honor as a young, aspiring painter when Thomas Cole, who painted these two paintings, agreed to accept Church as his first and, in fact, only pupil. Now, Cole had come to this country from England as a young man, but it was his doing, more than any other artist, that created landscape painting in this country during the early years of the 19th century as a viable and important expression about what many Americans felt was unique to the American nation. As you can imagine, the success of the American Revolution, the institution of American political systems, and in fact the growth of the American economy in the late 18th century and the early 19th century were all sources of tremendous pride for Americans. But Americans also sensed that they needed a national kind of art, something that could embody American aspirations and American ideals just as much as could the great achievements of the French and English and Italian schools of painting. Cole was the perfect sort of man to discover just what that was, because he believed that the American landscape itself, being unlike any other that Western civilization had ever come into contact with, was in its own way a source of pride. So he began painting these wonderful scenes of the American wilderness, such as the one on the left, which is a view of the Clove in the Catskill Mountains, or on the right, the famous Crawford Notch in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. And this kind of painting established for mid-19th century Americans an ideal of what American landscape art was all about. It was heroic in its subject, it was fresh in that it was unlike European painting, and it seemed to speak of American aspirations and dreams. The problem for Thomas Cole was that he believed that great art had to do something more than simply recreate the natural world, as he did in these two paintings. And throughout his own career, Cole struggled with two kinds of art, these realistic landscapes on the one hand, and other paintings, such as the famous four-part series, of which you see the first two now, called The Voyage of Life. The first painting is the one on the left. These are in the National Gallery in Washington, so some of you may have seen them there. And it's an allegory of human life. It starts with a boat coming out of a cavern with a small child. You can just barely see the child right there, with his guardian angel. And as the series progresses, this kind of everyman character grows older. The angel, in this instance of youth, has been put ashore while the youth literally is dreaming of castles in the sky. What he's not aware of, unfortunately, is that the river takes a rather sharp bend here and goes this way. And in fact, this is what he has. This is manhood. This is what we all have to deal with in our life. That is hard-going spirits in the air, the guardian angel now all the way back into the sky. And then in the final painting, old age, where the boat is broken, and in fact the man has reunited with the guardian angel and sees the pathway literally to heaven. Now this kind of painting to our minds, perhaps in the late 20th century, seems hopelessly kind of naive and idealistic. But to Cole, this was a way of using landscape as the means for conveying more profound ideas about the human condition. He deeply believed that the artist needed to do something more than just recreate physical reality. He had to address his art to these deeper concerns. The problem that Cole encountered, and it was a problem that his young pupil Frederick Church would have been very much aware of, was that American patrons, by and large, didn't like this kind of painting. They found it too imaginary, too unlike their everyday experience, unlike the things they knew about and that they were interested in. So Cole, throughout his career, struggled trying to reconcile how landscape painting could be made more ultimately meaningful and profound. It was in that way that his young pupil, Church, I believe, took up the challenge and in fact succeeded in a way that Cole probably never could have envisioned. Church began, as a pupil, as one would expect, imitating his master's style. You see on the left a painting by Cole from 1844 called The Old Mill at Sunset, one of those, again, archetypal American scenes of American nature and this old mill by the stream, very pastoral landscape with cows and children playing. This was the kind of landscape that American patrons tended to prefer. Church painted his own kind of less ambitious and slightly more student-like painting 2 years later, which is called Twilight Among the Mountains, a view across Catskill Creek towards the Catskill Mountains in New York State. And here's a young child, similar to what you see in Cole's, wandering through the landscape. Now, in this way, Church very quickly learned what his master's art offered him. He learned how to paint, he learned composition, and he learned certain basic ideas that Cole held about the American landscape. He learned, on the one hand, this kind of pastoral, calm approach to painting, but he also learned from his teacher that there was the more dramatic side of American landscape. And again, you see a Thomas Cole on the left called Landscape with Tree Trunks, and on the right, an early student work by his pupil Frederick Church called Blasted Tree. This kind of view of nature, the more dramatic, the more storm-tossed, was equally a part of the American experience because, as you know, much of America remained wild and unsettled into the 19th century, and some of these areas were little known, little explored, but had already been celebrated in American fiction, in particular in the fiction of James Fenimore Cooper and the Leatherstocking Tales. So Americans also liked this kind of painting. But Church was not oblivious to the fact that Cole had that other style of landscape, that higher, more profound style. And you see on the left a painting by Cole, which is actually a study for a famous painting he did, which was called The Expulsion from the Garden of Eden. Again, using landscape painting as the kind of foil for these ideas about human condition. And in the finished painting, the Garden of Eden, which is here, is contrasted with this rocky, dramatic landscape. And you see in the finished picture, not in the study, you see Adam and Eve literally being driven out of the garden through this great archway by an angel. Again, a very straightforward in its message, but for Cole, a more important kind of painting. Church imitated that kind of painting in this and other works from his early career. This is a scene from a series that Church was involved in, which showed this tiny figure here in armor. That's Christian from the famous John Bunyan book, Pilgrim's Progress. This is Christian, in fact, on the edge of the Valley of the Shadow of Death, where you see this very stormy, dark landscape with a fire cloud and stormy clouds above, the rocky landscape and dead tree, all very much like what you see in the Cole. So even though, and this is from 1847, even though Church was perfectly aware that Cole had struggled throughout his own career with unsuccessful receptions of these more allegorical, imaginary paintings, Church was deeply influenced by the fact that his master believed that these were what the artist should ultimately aspire to. You can see that even more clearly, perhaps, in this very recently discovered painting, which is Church's memorial painting, which was done when Thomas Cole died unexpectedly in 1848. Cole was only 47 years old, but contracted pneumonia from getting wet on one of his sketching tours and died very suddenly and very shockingly when he was literally at the height of his career and was the leader of American landscape painting. Church, interestingly enough, painted this work as not a literal memorial to the man, because Cole is nowhere present here, but one suggestion is that this perhaps is his grave. But it is, in fact, this cross relates to a series of unfinished works that Cole was doing called The Cross in the World, which was about spiritual pilgrimage. But you can't see it very well on the slide, but there's a stream which comes out of a dark cavern here and moves through the landscape, and you can just see it glinting down here, curves through the landscape and winds off to the distance, exactly like that river in The Voyage of Life. And Church was by that suggesting that it was this allegorical side of Cole's career, the man who believed that landscape was in fact a means for portraying profound ideas about human condition, that it was that side of Cole's art that should be memorialized at his death. Now that was a very extreme contrast to the other, perhaps more famous, memorial painting, which was done shortly after Cole's death. And this is by Asher B. Duran, a famous painter of the Hudson River School. And it actually shows Thomas Cole standing with his friend, the poet William Cullen Bryant. It shows Cole with his sketchbook and his walking stick looking at the clove of the Catskills, the subject of that early painting by Cole I showed you a little while ago. Duran was saying that what one needed to celebrate about Cole was his importance as a painter of American nature, not the man who painted those allegorical, imaginary works. Now, this was an important issue because with Cole's death in 1848, the American Landscape School had lost its leader. And the question was, who was to set the course? Who was to determine the future of American landscape painting? Durand himself very quickly moved to establish his own reputation in the late 1840s and early 1850s by painting works such as the one on the left, which is Dover Plains, Dutchess County, New York. It's that kind of painting which picks up the message that Durand stressed in his work Kindred Spirits, where he said, Cole's great achievement was showing us the American landscape, and that's what we should continue as his disciples and pupils. Now, Church was perfectly willing to agree with that attitude as far as it went, because immediately after Cole's death and after seeing Durand's Dover Plains and other similar landscapes, Church, at the age of 23, painted this work, which is called West Rock, New Haven. And on the face of it, this is, in fact, a perfectly straightforward, realistic view of a beautiful part of American nature. You see a haying scene in the bottom part of the picture, a beautiful, peaceful stream winding through the landscape, and this distinctive mountain in the background. In its realism, in its faithfulness to American nature, this seemed to be exactly what Durand had advised for the course of the American Landscape School. It suggests that the young Church had decided that that higher style of landscape that Cole had held so dear had no future in America. If you look at present-day West Rock, you can't get quite the same view, but you can see that Church's landscape was relatively faithful. I couldn't for the life of me find the stream when I was wandering around here. I think it must have been covered with this playing field. There's now a monument up on top of West Rock, but I was in the backyard of a high school here, and it's not the nicest part of New Haven, but if you've ever driven north out of New Haven towards Springfield, there's an interstate now that goes right through here, and the aptly named East Rock is right over here. You go right between the two of them. So it's a place you can still see today, not changed beyond recognition. But what intrigues me is that when I first started looking at Church's works and wondering about them, I was perplexed as to why he would so quickly give up all he had learned from Cole about how landscape could be more deeply meaningful. And I began to wonder about whether a picture like this might not have meant something to Church's contemporaries that was lost on us. And as I looked for the answer, I found an interesting book which was long out of print in America, but was very popular in 1852 when it appeared. It's called The Home Book of the Picturesque. It was a book of essays by different authors on famous scenes in America. And each chapter was illustrated with an engraving of a painting of the place that was being discussed. And you see, in fact, West Rock, New Haven, by Mary Field, the sister of the famous Cyrus Field, a friend of Church's, and in fact, the owner of this painting, the man who later went on to gain fame for laying the first transatlantic cable. But at any rate, there in this book is an engraving of Church's painting. Turn it around so you don't have to wonder if I'm pulling your leg or not. There it is. And as you read the chapter on West Rock, New Haven, it's quite interesting because after a few words describing the beauty of the scene, the author goes on to say, but West Rock has another interest. The artist here gives us not only a beautiful and well-known scene, but illustrates a passage in colonial history. Now, it seems curious that this could illustrate a passage in colonial history, but Mary Field went on to describe that in the 17th century, during the reign of Cromwell, three Englishmen who had opposed the monarchy and risen to positions of power had become very famous in the colonies because they spoke out against the tyranny of England over the American colonies. However, after the fall of Cromwell and the restoration of the monarchy, these men were obviously not welcome in England. They fled to America, and in the 1670s, they found their way to New Haven, where sympathetic colonists hid them in a cave on West Rock. That episode where these men who had opposed the tyranny of the English crown in favor of the colonies, where these men were protected and kept safe, was seen by 19th century America as a kind of prefiguration of the American Revolution. So that when an American of the 1850s looked at this painting, they knew something that we don't know unless you happen to be very well versed in Connecticut history, or unless you happen to know that that monument on top of West Rock is in fact a monument to those three men who were hidden there. In that way, Church had taken this very straightforward scene and found a way of giving it that added layer of meaning that made it profound and evocative in a way that Thomas Cole would have appreciated, but in a way that Thomas Cole probably never would have thought of himself. He always went to the imaginary, to the allegorical. Church, a much more practical, pragmatic sort of man, found another way. Unfortunately, as soon as Church had found this other way, he must have realized that America was too young as a nation, it had too few episodes like this for him to draw upon, and there were in fact already a host of popular illustrators who went around painting exactly this sort of sight. So Church began to wonder where he could go, what he could do to continue this ideal of Cole and yet remain faithful to the New World landscape. He began to travel very widely. Most of his contemporaries in the Hudson River School were content to go up, literally up the Hudson River, and paint the Catskills. But Church was more daring, much more of an explorer. And by 1850, he had found he was one of the first important artists, and one of the first artists in any sense, to find his way to Maine, where he painted both of the works now on the screen. The one on the left, a striking view of a beacon off Mount Desert Island, this beacon that was by day a marker visible from sea, and at night, if ships were approaching, the barrel on top could be lit. And he shows this extraordinarily dramatic view out across the open ocean into the sunrise, looking eastward. This is the kind of scene that most Americans had never laid eyes on. And he also painted in Maine much smaller, more informal sketches, such as this very, very beautiful one, again, from Mount Desert Island, of the surf breaking on the wave. This is an extraordinarily avant-garde for its day, almost precocious landscape. It really looks much more like a Winslow Homer than it does a mid-century American painting. So Church was very quickly finding his way technically. He was, by the time he was in his mid-20s, by far the most gifted painter in America in terms of technique and ability, but he was also pushing the limits of what American landscape could tell Americans about their own nation. He was exploring, he was going farther beyond the boundaries of what had previously been considered sort of interesting subject matter, and he was looking for more and more dramatic scenery. This is Grand Manan Island, where this extraordinary range of rocks lead right down to the ocean, very unusual geologic formation. And Church, in going to places like Grand Manan, was not only seeking spectacular scenery, he was also seeking scenery that was unlike anything that was found in Europe, and he was seeking scenery that was just now beginning to gain the attention of writers, and particularly of scientists, who were interested in what kinds of geologic forces had created this New World landscape that was so different than any known anywhere else in the world. So Church began exploring right along with scientists, writers, and some of the most intelligent and interesting people in America in the 1850s were his acquaintances. He traveled into the South to see Virginia's famous Natural Bridge, which Thomas Jefferson had found so intriguing that he in fact bought it when he had the opportunity, owned it for many years. And Church went there with his friend Cyrus Field, the man I mentioned before, and was intrigued by this great natural wonder. And Cyrus Field made a little gamble. Field, without Church knowing it, bent down, picked up a few rocks from the site, which were the color of Natural Bridge, and put them in his pocket, and then bet Church that he could not faithfully portray the exact geological structure and color of Natural Bridge once he was back in New York. Well, Church was never one to let a dare pass, and this painting is the result. And when Church showed it to Field, Field got out the rocks and said, "You've done it," and then had no course except to buy the painting, which he did. But this kind of picture is not only playing on the earlier aspect that I mentioned with Asher Duran's work of the reality of American subject matter. It's faithful in that it portrays the American scene, but it also is more up-to-date in the way it engages the viewer in a dialogue with American science, American natural history, and in fact, again, in Natural Bridge of Virginia, for those who knew something about American history, they would have known this famous site. They would have known that Thomas Jefferson wrote about it in his notes on the state of Virginia. They would have known that European visitors to America came specifically to see this kind of scenery. So Church, by the early 1850s, had broadened, literally had expanded, the whole notion of what American landscape painting could be all about. And it was at that moment, right around 1850-51, that he read a book that changed, literally, the course of his career. It was one of those moments that comes for many artists when they're exposed to something that completely alters the way they think of the world. And that book was a very famous, again, a book which virtually every literate American of the 1850s would have been familiar with it if, in fact, they didn't actually own it. It was called Cosmos, a sketch of a physical description of the universe, rather ambitious, by Alexander von Humboldt, a great German scientist, natural historian, one of the last great minds of the Enlightenment, a man who believed that through careful observation, through study, through a lifetime of experience, and then through the workings of his own mind and imagination, that you could come to a complete understanding of the entire natural world, literally, the cosmos. When Church found this book, and when he looked in volume one, he discovered that Humboldt had written a long chapter on landscape painting. Humboldt traced the history of landscape painting from the earliest days, from Greek and Roman attempts, right up to his own present day. And what Humboldt lamented in this survey of landscape painting was that there was no artist with whom he was familiar who understood the world properly in terms of scientific knowledge, in terms of awareness of the greater issues of the cosmos and how natural systems work together, and who was capable of realizing all of those issues in a single painting. Humboldt believed that the world was made up of distinct zones that were dominated by climate, so that the temperate zone of North America created its own distinctive flora and fauna, and in fact that everything that sprang out of a particular region of the world, civilization, nature, all of those things were dominated by the characteristic scientific aspects of that part of the world. When Church read about what Humboldt believed in his theories and his ideas about landscape painting, it was like literally a new door had opened for him. Here was a way to create landscape paintings that addressed issues which went far beyond the literal specifics of any one place, to create a kind of ideal of individual portions of the world. And the first painting that Church did, which took into account those ideas, was the one that brought him perhaps his most immediate fame. It was a work called New England Scenery from 1851. Now, the title itself suggests, unlike, say, Beacon off Mount Desert, which names a place, or the Natural Bridge, or Grand Manan, all specific places, this is New England Scenery. It suggests an entire sort of region of America, and in fact, Church included distinctive mountains like New England, waterfall, a lake, a New England church. Whenever you see a church in Church's paintings, it's inevitably a pun, but this one in fact also has a role It's a white steepled New England church, a sawmill. Interestingly enough, he also included a Conestoga wagon moving out of the picture, as if this vision of New England is now being used to settle the far reaches of the country. Church did not mean for this painting to be recognized by those who saw it as a specific place. He meant for everyone to understand that in the sense that Humboldt's theory said that the artist should convey the essence of entire regions of the globe, that this was, in fact, New England scenery. It showed everything about the characteristic aspects of this part of the New World. Church added his own kind of interpretation because he wanted it to be clear that Americans were hard workers, they had sawmills, that they were religious, they went to church, that they took and used the bounty of the natural land by clearing it, planting fields and raising animals, and that they were not going to spoil this natural bounty, but that when it was time to move on, they would, so that overpopulation would not become an issue. This is, in fact, a highly programmatic in that it was meant to be read and understood by Church's contemporaries. It's a programmatic image. It's a kind of text of a painting. His contemporaries understood this perfectly, and that's why the painting was such an enormous success. It seemed to embody all that was most appealing about American nature, about American civilization, and again, about American nationalist ideals. This period of the 1850s, before the Civil War, was perhaps the highest tide in American nationalism. It was when Americans felt that their own achievements in terms of technology, economy, every aspect, literature and art, were now capable of being seen as fully competitive with the greatest achievements of the European world. So Americans were very, very eager to believe in this kind of painting. Church began then to create ever more ambitious paintings. He began to roam. He began to think about aspects of American nature that went beyond anything that had been conceived of before. And he also, in reading Cosmos, was aware that there was an entire world out there that no other landscape painter had ever paid any attention to. And that was the world of South America. Just two photographs of South America. No major artist of Church's era had ever even set foot in South America. Humboldt had done much of his writing, his experimenting, and his studies in South America, and Humboldt believed that South America was an untapped great natural resource that Western civilization should literally take over. Many Americans in Church's day believed that the North American nation, should in fact expand into South American territory. And in fact, the 1850s saw some of the most expansive territorial politics of our national history, the annexation of California, of Mexico, of vast amounts of territory. So in Church's day, South America was not seen as a separate world, but very much part of the broader New World. So Church went to South America and came back and began painting pictures such as this one on the right, called Morning on the Cordilleras, the great spine of mountains through the Andes. And it was this kind of picture, as well as one such as the painting on the left, compared to a photograph of the same scene, of the great volcano Cotopaxi, that again opened up an entire new scope for landscape painting in America in the mid-1850s. Americans had literally never seen anything like these pictures. These South American paintings, together with the North American paintings that Church had already executed, made him by far the most famous painter in America of the decade of the 1850s. He was so successful, he was so encouraged, and so much aware of his own talent, that Church now began a series of major landscapes that were unparalleled in their ambition, in their literal size, and in their recognition of American nationalist associations. The first of those was one of his most famous paintings. And that's the very, very large, 9-foot-wide painting that you see on the left and the detail on the right of Niagara Falls. Again, this was a subject that, though countless artists had tried to paint it, none of them had ever been able to accomplish what Church did, and that was literally to recreate the scene as if you were actually there. You can imagine yourself standing, in fact, on the Canadian side, overlooking the falls, and this detail gives you some idea of just the sheer technical accomplishment of Niagara, the way the water is portrayed. John Ruskin, the famous English critic, when this painting was exhibited in England, Ruskin saw the painting from across the room and saw this rainbow of spray that is one of the features of Niagara, and was so convinced by the illusionism of the painting that he went to the window across the room and started waving his hand trying to figure out why the refraction of light was playing across the canvas. Church had, in essence, fooled the greatest English critic of his day, and in that sense, Niagara was an international triumph. This painting, like the Heart of the Andes, which followed it immediately, was exhibited by itself, paid admission, and you went into the gallery where you could see this enormous painting, which literally overwhelmed you. There again were broadsides, newspaper articles, all kinds of interpretations. Religious writers would look at this and say that Niagara was a constant reminder of the great flood which God had brought upon the world once to cleanse it of sin, and that this was a reminder that the new world was like the world after the flood in the Bible, a place where man could begin again, that this was a reminder that God had saved the new world for man, and that the rainbow, which appeared after Noah had found Mount Ararat as a sign of God's covenant with Noah, was in fact a sign of God's covenant with Americans. So religious writers and thinkers could find their own message in the painting. Scientists could find their message in that this great natural wonder of America was, again, unlike anything known anywhere else in the world. And Americans who simply wanted to take pride in their scenery could find their own reasons for liking it. What Church had done, in essence, was create a kind of landscape that encouraged far more than simple appreciation for looking at it. It encouraged people to think, to ask questions, to make associations. And in doing that, they would be led, Church believed, ultimately to those deeper, more profound ideas about themselves, about their nation, and about mankind at large that Cole had tried through purely imaginary means to achieve. And that brings us back to the work that we began with, The Heart of the Andes. As I mentioned, an enormous, large, large painting exhibited by itself in this very carefully orchestrated, even theatrical setting. And when you went into the room, as I mentioned, you could have picked up pamphlets which would describe it to you, but you were also encouraged to imagine that you were not standing in a gallery in New York or Cincinnati or London, among the places where the painting was sent on tour, but you should imagine that you were actually there and that you could, by being there, learn something about the natural world. And if you remember what Alexander von Humboldt believed, that there were zones of the world that were distinct in their topography, in their flora and fauna, that these zones of the world could, in their way, teach you about the greater cosmos, then the Heart of the Andes, just like New England scenery, was meant to be literally that, the heart of this region of the world. And you were encouraged to take your opera glasses or tin tubes and to study the painting. In fact, if you go to the Metropolitan, what you should do is take a piece of paper and roll it up and look at the painting that way. And don't worry, the guards won't think you're crazy because they've seen me do it a lot. And in fact, they do it now too. Because when you do that, you remove your sense that you're standing in a room because you can't see anything except the piece of the painting you're looking at. And Church very, very skillfully constructed this painting so that there are, in fact, multiple vanishing points, perspective lines, so that if you look at just, we'll go through the painting a little bit detail by detail, but as you look at one section of it with your tube or your opera glasses, the illusionism is so complete that you can literally imagine yourself present in the scene. And the quality, the technical skill with which this is painted, is that every detail on this 10-foot painting is so miraculously correct that, again, you can imagine yourself there. Now, if you were to pick up one of the pamphlets that was available and read it, as you studied the painting, there were various ways you could go through it. Reverend Lewis Noble, whom I mentioned early when I first began talking, was Church's friend. Reverend Lewis Noble believed that you should find in this great mountain, Chimborazo, in the background, that this should remind you of the city of God, that this was sort of like the ultimate sort of yearning of mankind for heaven, and that as you toured through the landscape, you would find other reminders of man's place in nature, of man's relationship to his creator, and of the wonder of the creation of the natural world. Church's friend Theodore Winthrop, whom I quoted earlier, believed that you didn't need to go through looking for these religious associations, that you could tour the landscape as a kind of open book to learn about nature and its creation, so that you began first up here and then gradually worked your way down into the through the mountains and through this midland plain down here, where you could study these wonderfully complex vines and foliage. Church, very interestingly, I don't know if you can see it, signed the painting by carving his name on the tree. It's a wonderful touch, as if he had been there. Then you move your way across and see this path where there are, in fact, two pilgrims who come to this cross. Again, the presence of religion, and there is also a church in the far distance. So Church, again, melded the scientific, the natural, the real world with this religious world, so that in his own way, his works of art did more than a work which chose one or the other course. Then as you work your way across, you see this great stand of trees here, and then finally go right up literally to the face of the painting and see this extraordinary, intricate detail. A botanist could come, and we have records of scientists who would come and look at this painting, and they could identify every species of plant here. So the literal realism, the religious associations, and the sheer exotic beauty of this painting made it meaningful, elevating, uplifting, literally, in a way that Cole, I think, would have approved of, but never could have envisioned himself. Sunday school teachers brought their classes to see this painting. As I mentioned, Mark Twain, virtually every American writer who we have any record of from this time, was aware of having seen this painting. In its day in New York, probably 50,000 people went to see it. It's an extraordinary achievement for a single painting, let alone an entire exhibition of works of art, when you remember that the entire population of New York in the 1850s was probably no more than, I don't know, a million, million and a half. 50,000 people went specifically to see it. After this painting, Church embarked on a series of landscapes that proceeded literally to catalog the entire known world.